Hi, welcome to the sixth episode of Scott's Spill the Beans. I'm Kim McAllister and this is the last in the series, but what a finale I have for you. If you were listening last week to my chat with golfer Paul Laurie, you'll have heard me tease you that I had a big surprise in store for the last one in the series. Well, I deliver on my promises. Today's guest is Judy Murray. I've admired this woman for about a decade, so it was a real treat to chat to her. Isn't it wonderful when your heroes exceed your expectations? Now, Judy is an extremely busy lady, so I had to do this interview over the phone, but even though the sound quality isn't quite as sharp as you're used to on this podcast, I think you'll cope just fine.
Judy, thank you so much for chatting to me today. When we first met in a restaurant, you sympathised with me having two noisy boys and you said that you remembered it well, which really gave a harassed mother hope, considering the superstars that your sons have become. How do you feel about being a kind of mum role model?
I don't think I ever really think of it like that. You're just a mum like everyone else. You know, when you become a parent for the first time, you probably do a lot of the things that you remember your own mum doing with you or your parents doing with you. And certainly for me, my mum and dad were very sporty. So for as far back as I can remember, it was always about my mum and dad being out in the garden or on the beach with me and my brothers doing active things, you know, whether that was badminton across the washing line or we had homemade football goals in the back garden and French cricket. Those are the things I remember. Sport has formed such an enormous part of my life. So, you know, when my kids were small, I kind of did all of those things with them as well. It's a job for life. It doesn't matter how old they are. They're still your kids and you still worry about them and you're still there if they need you. But, for me, it's all about creating opportunities and being supportive, whether things are going well or not so well.
Exactly. And, you know, my friends wanted to know, what did you feed your boys for breakfast? Because they bet they didn't get Lucky Charms.
They had a lot of Cocoa Pops. They did drink a lot of milk, but more in the form of milkshakes. Because, I mean, I'm not particularly tall, and neither is their dad, but both of the boys are 6'3". And, you know, the only thing I can really think that it might have contributed to that was actually milk.
All that calcium, that's the secret. And we're all juggling a lot, mothers, these days, and you in particular were so dedicated to your children and their sporting goals. What did you find most difficult as they were growing up, juggling everything?
It's probably the trying to get them to everything. When kids are very small, it's always the parents who enroll them into activities, you know, whether that's the Cubs or football or rugby or tumble tots, you know, whatever it is. And then they get to probably between 8 and 10, they start to pick and choose the things that they enjoy the best. And the number of activities probably that they've tried, they've whittled down to 2 or 3. And I think that's when it became quite tricky if they were doing different things from each other. And you just become the human taxi service and the human ATM machine and the human laundry, et cetera, human cafe. I think it is that the planning everything and being able to get them to and from what they're doing. I was probably quite fortunate in that they are only 15 months apart and obviously they're the same sex. So a lot of the things that they did together, but not everything. And then, of course, when they have their own separate groups of friends and one lot wants to go to the swimming pool and one lot wants to go and play football in the park, and it's that sort of thing where you can't split yourself in two. So actually when they both wanted to go to the tennis club was an easy one for me.
That's why you encouraged it. Great, Mum only needs to do one taxi run today.
Yeah, I think, you know, as they got older, certainly into their high school years, and they were starting to need to do a little bit more of their tennis during school hours. And, you know, I remember Andy dropping a couple of subjects at school, art and RE, I think, was the two that he dropped to create a little bit of time where he could come out and go down to the indoor tennis centre to do some additional training. And that becomes a juggle as well, because obviously somebody's got to get him from school, get him to the centre, hang around while he does it, and then get him back up to school again. Jamie was the same. He didn't come out quite as often. It wasn't that they came out much, but it is the juggling act between the the hobbies or the sports that they do, the social, as in their what they do with their pals and family, and obviously the education piece as well. So it is always a juggle. And I think nowadays many more mums work, so it becomes even tougher, mm-hmm. you know, because you have less time, maybe more money to pay for more activities or more things for the family to do, but certainly less time perhaps to do it with them. And I think that's a big thing for me societally, is, you know, encouraging parents to do more things with their kids rather than paying other people or programming them into another activity, because that sort of intergenerational bonding and communication piece is so important, and we're in so much danger from screens, you know, kids shutting themselves away in their rooms for hours and not talking to anybody and just, you know, conversing through a screen. And that really worries me as a societal thing.
I totally agree, and I think there's nothing more fun than just taking a ball to a park with your kids. It doesn't need any money, it doesn't need any expertise really, certainly not on my part, and they're so happy, aren't they, just to have your attention and play and have fun with you, aren't they?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And, you know, we used to do a lot of that with the kids, and so did my mum and dad with my kids. So they had built-in playmates within the family, you know, from a young age. But it's one of the things that I have spent a lot of time on the last 4 or 5 years. I run this little program called Tennis on the Road, and it's basically a van full of equipment, and myself and another coach, we spend about 50 days a year travelling around Scotland, taking tennis into rural and deprived areas, and we build workforces out of the local community. So whether that's teachers, students, youth leaders, parents is a big thing for us, because in many communities there aren't any tennis coaches, and even if there were, there isn't always money to pay for tennis lessons. So parents for me are the sort of hidden secret workforce, and if we can show parents how they can help their kids to develop physical skills just through playing with them, like you say, the ball in the park, or, you know, kicking it through a hoop, or kicking it between the jerseys, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And the social skills as well, because as you say, they spend so much time on screens. It's really nice to spend time with kids and learn about sharing and falling down and sorting out fights and all the rest of the stuff that
goes
with
it. Yeah, just communication skills, leadership skills, resilience. Yeah, there's so much that sport and play, you know, in large-ish groups can teach kids that set them up for life skills.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And it's interesting you're talking about the role of parents, because I was once lucky enough to meet Sir Alex Ferguson, and he was talking about when he was signing young players, he was always very keen to get the mothers on board, because he realised they
yeah,
were the ones,
big thing for him.
Yeah, that were kind of in control of the family, if you like. And you're obviously a fantastic example of a mother who helped her children achieve. Do you feel like there's enough recognition for the role of mums?
I think I've had that conversation with him, with Sir Alex as well, about the mums, and it kind of made me giggle, because there are an awful lot of coaches out there who want to hold the mums at arm's length, and I was the absolute opposite. You know, when I started as a volunteer coach at Dunblane Tennis Club when my kids were toddlers, and I really went over to have something to do that would get me out of the house for a couple of hours a week and keep me active. And mm-hmm. there was no coaches at our club. So I started to play with some of the older, you know, the older juniors at the club. And as I created more activity, or more parents asked me if their kids could join in, I realised I couldn't do it all myself. So I started like a mum's army. And it was, you know, basically we had mums organising some of the matches for the junior teams and the school teams. We had mums running the cafes. We had mums putting other kids up overnight, and, you know, sharing car runs to little competitions and things like that. And it was, you know, it was all the mums, and it worked absolutely perfectly, because nobody wants things to happen more for their kids than the parents. And generally speaking, it's the mums who are the ones who are around most during those formative years. So mm-hmm. I'm a huge believer in involving and encouraging parents in whatever activities their kids are doing, because the more that the parents understand about the demands of that sport or that hobby, the better they can help the kids. And of course, if you're a coach, you understand that the parent is with the child 99% of the time, and you mm-hmm. have them for 1% of the time. So who has the biggest influence? The parents. So you bring the parents on side and you all work it together. It's a thing, I think they call it the parent-coach-player triangle. So mm-hmm. you're basically all in it all in it together. But yeah, I'm a big believer in the, you know, in the, well, in the parent thing. But I guess in certainly during those primary school years, especially definitely. In the mums.
Yeah, definitely. And during this podcast, I spoke to Paul Laurie, who has a fabulous golf academy, I'm sure you're aware, up in Aberdeen.
Yes.
And you're obviously doing something similar with tennis in that you're trying to involve as many children and kind of open it up and be as accessible as possible. He said the most important element for him with his kids that are in his academy is fun. Would you agree with that with tennis and your children that you work with?
Yes, absolutely, because it has to be fun. Because you want them to come back, you have to create a social environment for them. So whether that's a club or a centre like Paul has, it's a base where the kids can all come together. And of course, they're going to work hard at whatever activity it is that they're doing, and they have to be able to learn. So the teaching has to be of great quality as well. But it's the social environment and the fun that will keep them coming back every week. So I'm exactly like Paul. It's about big numbers, and it's about creating a social hub where kids can thrive.
Mm-hmm. And what is it you love about tennis?
Well, actually, what I always loved about it was the tactical side and the mental side. I liked competing. I grew up in an era where, you know, you played tennis in the summer and you played badminton in the winter because there was no indoor courts. And nobody really took tennis seriously, very much a minority sport because you could only play it about 5-6 months of the year. So there was no coaches, there was nobody aspiring to be world class. I mean, you can't play for Scotland at tennis. It's a GB sport.
Mm-hmm.
So it was never a big sport back in my day. And I learned how to play tennis first through my parents and then through playing with the other kids at the club and then the adults at the club, because if you become quite a good junior, you were in those days invited to join in with some of the adult competitions and the ladies teams and the ladies club nights. And you learn from the adult members how to play the game. And nowadays the world is so different because kids are programmed into all sorts of activities across a week, and it's all about far too much coaching, in my opinion. You know, tennis is one of those sports where you have to work out how to beat the person on the other side of the net.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be able to not only think about what you're doing, but you have to be able to understand what's going on the other side of the net, because your goal, of course, is to make life difficult for your opponent. So we have to learn how to. You have to learn how to compete. You have to learn how to solve the problem of the point that you're playing. You know, how do I do this better? How do I get myself out of trouble in this point? How do I cause trouble to my opponent? How do I avoid trouble? These are all the sort of questions that I ask the kids, you know, when I'm coaching them. Because, you know, if we tell, or we provide them with gadgets that give them the answers when they type something in or they speak to it and it just tells you what the answer is, you're actually not preparing them for life, really. You know,
no,
you've got
I
to
totally
be able to
agree.
Solve problems. So for me, the playing of the game, the tactical, working out how to make it tough for your opponent, and the mental side, I was very competitive. Those were the bits that I enjoyed the most about it, more than just the hitting the ball.
You mentioned when you were growing up the tennis facilities weren't what you would probably have liked, given your aptitude for the sport. Do you feel like they're better? Do you feel like we're investing and, I guess, profiting from your boys and the legacy that they're leaving?
It's certainly better than my day, but, I mean, that was a long, long time ago. I mean, I'm talking about 45 or so years ago, so of course you'd expect everything to move on. And, you know, we have some indoor facilities. We're still very short of pay and play indoor facilities. We have 6, I think, in the whole of Scotland, and we've had those same 6. They were built between 1994, I think, was the first one at Stirling, and 2006. You know, so actually to just have 6 for the whole country is really hardly anything. So there are massive pockets of the country where kids and adults can't play all year round, which basically means nobody can coach all year round. So in terms of developing an excellent workforce or a world-class workforce, you don't have career opportunities for very many people. So it's, for me, it's really so disappointing that no new indoor pay-and-play facilities were built between 2006 and 2016, which, of course, were the years in which Jamie and Andy won you know, their Grand Slams, the Davis Cup, and became world number ones in singles, and Andy in singles and Jamie in doubles. So, you know, to have that level of success in a global individual sport by Scottish people, which would never, nobody would ever have anticipated that happen because of tennis just being a minority sport up here, but we really haven't capitalised on it in terms of either indoor facilities, public facilities in parks or in state schools, because of course if people watch it on the TV and they get enthused by what the boys are doing and they want to go out and try it, you're not going to rock up and join a club just like that. You want to find the courts in the park or the courts at a school, you know, a state school, to give yourself a chance to play. But we haven't capitalized on that. And the other thing that goes along with additional facilities is obviously investment in a workforce, because you need people to deliver activity, create competitions and little leagues and all the rest of it, because you want them to play the game. You don't just want people to go out and, you know, hit a ball from time to time. You want to sort of really captivate them and enthuse them to actually stay in the game and compete out with, you know, what often is just the summer period following Wimbledon when everybody gets very excited about tennis.
Absolutely.
So I don't... We haven't capitalised on the opportunity, and it's for me it's very sad, because, you know, time's running out. Andy and Jamie won't play forever, and we'll never have this kind of leverage again. So it's really important that we push now for additional funding and investment to really take advantage of that. And it's really 5 years ago I started the project just outside Dunblane to build a... it's actually a multi-sport and leisure complex with tennis at the heart of it. But, you know, tennis, if you, in my opinion, the days of the single sport clubs are coming to an end. I think clubs have to offer more than just golf or just tennis. I think, you know, this whole thing of joining forces and being able to offer families more than one activity is actually really, really important now. So I surrounded tennis with golf, with some five-a-side football, some adventure park, you know, cycle paths through the woods, fitness trails, indoor and outdoor tennis, obviously, soft playrooms, some climbing walls inside, a gym and a cafe. So it becomes a destination where the whole family can go.
Yeah.
and do things together, or do things separately, because there's so much choice in the one place.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm a huge believer in the family thing, as we spoke about before. But if I tried to build tennis on its own, it would have been so expensive to build indoor courts that you end up having to pass the cost on mm-hmm. to the consumer, which is why often, well, always actually, indoor tennis becomes very, very expensive. I mean, mm-hmm. you have charges from sort of £22 to £28 an hour for an indoor court across Scotland at the pay and play centres. Now that's out with most people's weekly budget, you know, if you're a family. Mm-hmm. I certainly couldn't have afforded that when my kids were small. So we had to surround the tennis with other things so that it operates as one complex, and mm-hmm. the money that you can make from some of the other leisure activities and the cafe and the gym and so forth can allow us to offset the costs of the tennis and the golf to make those two sports more accessible and more affordable to more families.
Mm-hmm. What stage are you at with that?
Yeah, we had we got planning permission in outline, and we're just finalising, well, the design and the business plan. Well, they're actually finalised, so we just have to get a sign off from Stirling Council, and you know, hopefully we're pretty close to that.
Oh, that
now,
would be wonderful.
bringing all the potential funding partners together to try to build it debt-free because we're running it as a charitable trust, so that any profits that it generates in years to come are just put back into the sport and leisure activity. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, the whole thing is it's a fabulous project. And, of course, if we create a successful sporting and business model here, it could be replicated in other parts of the country. Not by me, but I mean as a way of showing how you make sport and leisure sustainable
mm-hmm.
and make it fun, stimulating environment, destination for
wow.
families to come. Because we have this massive obesity crisis in Scotland,
mm-hmm.
and I know some of it, of course, is created by what we eat, but it's also created by inactivity. So to make activity fun and get people out wanting to do it, you need environments and destinations that people want to go to, that they get excited by. And that's my whole point with everything that we are putting into the centre.
That sounds wonderful. And I'm only in Edinburgh, so that's not too far.
you can come
bring the whole family and stay for days. Yeah. One of my boys would absolutely love that. It sounds fabulous. And it's funny, you just casually mentioned as we were chatting there, you know, my son's singles champion, my son's doubles champion. I mean, it's just incredible what you as a family have achieved. And I think as a Scottish person, it's just wonderful to have these two Scots both performing so well, and then their brothers. And what would you say are the Scottish qualities that they embody?
Oh, stubbornness for sure. and you have to be, and resilience. You know, you have to refuse to give in. You keep fighting. I think those are two huge qualities. But they're both very humble. They're both very grounded. I think that's a very Scottish trait as well. We're not great at being ambitious. I'd say the boys are definitely ambitious, but they have never forgotten their roots, and I think that's a good old Scottish trait too.
Definitely. I think that's definitely, especially when Andy's doing his interviews, that's what everybody loves, is he's just so normal. You just feel like you could just go to the pub with him and have a pint and there wouldn't be any star behaviour at all. And when you travel, what do people ask you about Scotland?
I would say that it doesn't matter where you go, and if people ask you where you're from and you say Scotland, everybody goes, oh, Scotland, you know, and they immediately think of mountains and castles and golf and whiskey. But I think people love the sound of Scotland being somewhere quirky and scenic and gorgeous. So I feel that, especially when you're in America, they seem to love the whole thing of kilts and kilts and castles. But I think what the boys have done with tennis, because it's such a huge global sport, is they've really put Scotland on the sporting map. It would be nice to have a bricks and mortar something that says this is the story of Andy and Jamie. You know, they lived in the town just right there, and this is their journey. So, because our plan is that the cafe, that we'll do it up a bit like a Hard Rock Cafe, but it'll be with all Andy and Jamie's memorabilia, and it'll tell the story of, you know, how they got started and the pictures of them when they're tiny with their rackets that are too big for them. And everything. So it's about sharing the story. But I think the bigger story for me is, I hope, is the inspiration that what they achieved against all the odds would inspire Scotland's kids and youth to work hard at whatever it is they enjoy doing. And that it's just that message of, you know, if you believe in yourself and you work hard and somebody creates some opportunities for you somewhere along the way, because nobody gets anywhere without somebody opening a door here and there for them, you know, whether that's a coach or a teacher or a parent or a sponsor. It is that whole thing of, you know, anything's possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a fabulous story, and it makes you so proud to be like, yeah, he's Scottish. Before we go, I'd like to do the Scots Spill the Beans quiz with you. This is just your recommendations around Scotland for people who are coming to visit. So when it comes to a bar with your friends, which is your favourite bar or pub to go to?
Actually, I like the American Bar at Glen Eagles. As in newly refurbished, it's very sort of 1920s, very sort of Charleston era. I can't say that I go in there really all that often, but if you're looking for somewhere special to go that's quiet, has an incredible ambiance, and where they will make the cocktails in front of you and explain everything that they're putting into you, that's a very special treat.
That's cool. And your favourite restaurant to go out around Scotland?
Actually, I really love the restaurant at Andy's Hotel at Cromlix. It's a Chez Roux restaurant, and of course it's close by, and it's got an open kitchen, and I always enjoy watching the chefs sort of finishing everything off before they bring it over to you. But yeah, I love the ambiance in there, and the food is just fabulous, and then, you know, the menus are changed every 3 months or so according to the season, so it mixes things up on a regular basis quite nicely. But yeah, I love going there.
Yeah, it's definitely top of my list. I've not been there yet. Your favourite hotel around Scotland?
I actually really love the the Eriska Hotel on the Isle of Eriska, which is not far from Oban. So it's on a very tiny little island, and it's a big old country house. So, you know, very traditional, very cosy, log fires, you know, chocolate and coffee and shortbread in the drawing room, and it's just peace and quiet. Like, your mobile phone doesn't work there, you know, so you have complete peace and quiet. And when you walk around the little island, it's only about a mile and a half, you hear nothing but the occasional bird. I bet it's, you know, it's got a nice spa and gorgeous walks. And if I want complete peace and quiet, that's where I would go. So I love that.
Sounds like heaven. And your favourite beach around Scotland?
Yeah, probably St Andrews.
It's beautiful.
Probably
there.
The beach at St Andrews. So I'll walk along the beach at St Andrews, followed by a game of Himalayas on that bumpy, lumpy putting green that's just beside the beach.
Are you a golfer? Do you play golf as well?
No, I don't, but I like that putting green. I like the challenge of it. I like the tactical, mental side of that putting green.
And finally, your favourite Scottish brand. I guess Andy Murray was a pretty good brand.
I'm going to say Tunnocks Caramel Wafers. Tunnocks.
Oh, you're making me hungry. Judy, it's been such a delight speaking to you. Thank you so much for chatting to me today.
Pleasure, Kim. Pleasure.
Thank you.
Good luck with it all.
Gosh, imagine being casually able to drop into conversation that both your sons are world champions. I'm really excited about Judy's sports complex. Hopefully I'll chat to her again when the Jamie and Andy Murray Cafe is open. Thank you so much for listening to the Scots Spill the Beans podcast. I hope you've enjoyed the chats with Paul Laurie, Gavin Hastings, Jack Derrick, Christina Thompson and Craig McGinley. If you've missed any, please go back and listen. And if you're feeling generous, you could always leave a review. I actually have one more bonus episode that I'm planning. It involves whiskey, so I'm looking forward to it. Please subscribe and follow us on Instagram @ScotsSpillTheBeans, and have a good one.